Welcome to our Leadership Intelligence podcast series. The title of today's session is The Trust Factor in Leadership. My name is Charles Rogel, and I'm the Vice President of Products and Marketing for DecisionWise. I'll be moderating our podcast today. Our presenter is Brad Taylor.
Hello there.
Brad is the Vice President of Consulting Services here at DecisionWise and joined us recently after a long and illustrious career of 30 years at General Mills, where he most recently served as the Vice President of HR. At DecisionWise, Brad leads our team of consultants who deliver analysis, coaching, and training to clients around the world. Today, we'll be talking about the trust factor in leadership. So, Brad, to begin, why this particular topic?
Well, I suppose there are a lot of reasons, and we'll talk about some of those. But I was just watching a Jimmy Kimmel late night funny program. And this was many of you that are listening to this will have seen this. It's where Jimmy Kimmel asks parents to lie to their kids and tell them that they have eaten all of the kids' Halloween trick-or-treat candy and film them. And film their reaction. And I laugh hysterically when I see some of the outrageous responses from these kids. But at the core of it, it dawned on me as I was thinking about trust in a corporate setting that there really isn't much difference. Adults mask their reactions to a broken trust probably better than these kids.
Yeah, not so much. These kids throw a fit.
Kids absolutely go ballistic in the funniest ways. But some of the core principles are the same, and they're so true. For example, the human reaction to any kind of a broken trust is immediate and it's strong. And the trust is hard to earn, but in as much as it's hard to earn, it's so quick that we can lose it. That trust equation, the some people call it the trust account. We have to put a whole lot in, and boy, one small infraction and the account is empty.
And it could be even when you didn't intend to break trust or even commit a mistake, it could be interpreted as such, and then the trust is still compromised.
Exactly. And not all, the one thing that may be a little bit different than the Jimmy Kimmel thing is that in the workplace, not all trust deficits are a result of a direct violation. A lot of times my experience is, boy, we've made a new acquisition and these people are just new to me. I don't know that we hired 100 new college grads. I don't know them yet. So
yeah.
there are other factors that are certainly different than the trick or treat trick.
Right. So, Brad, you like to talk about trust in terms of this equation, right?
Yes.
You want to explain that?
Absolutely. I really do think there's a trust equation. And you know, I'm not a great mathematician, but I kind of picture it as a simple mathematic equation where in the numerator or the top side of the equation, you've got competence, reliability, and relationship. And, you know, they're mostly straightforward. At least the first two are for sure. Competence, I trust you because I know that you can do the job. I know that you have the knowledge and the raw capability to get it done. And that's critical. Without that, you know, in the workplace, you're not even off of square one.
Mm-hmm.
So that's pretty straightforward. Number two is equally straightforward, I think. It's reliability. I've got a brother who has all of the talent and capability in the world, but I can't count on him to show up. And so there's no... There, in one sense, at least, there's no trust there. So you got to be reliable. I got to be able to count on that you can do it and that you will show up. You show up, you'll follow through, you'll be where you need to be.
Yeah, it's like the contractor who's supposed to be really good and never shows up to complete your kitchen.
Well said, exactly. Now, the third one in the numerator is not quite, as I talk with people, I realize it's not quite as straightforward. I use the word relationship. And I guess what I'm talking about there is that some people dispute me, I should say, and say, look, it stops at your first two.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you show me a person with the right competence and the right reliability, I'm done. I trust them. But this is an interesting quiz that my wife once threw at me. It was about, the analogy was babysitting. And it was coming out of People magazine, I think. But
an authoritative source.
Yeah, authoritative source. But I found it to be a real pearl of truth. And that is that the quiz was, who would you hire? If any of you have ever hired a babysitter, who would you hire? The babysitter who you've never met, but they come with 15 years of experience, with every kind of credible babysitter accreditation that you can earn and achieve, with many letters of recommendation, and with every kind of certification that you could have.
Mm-hmm.
Or would you hire the 13-year-old girl who lives next door, that's a part of a family that you know and love and trust, and you also know the girl and trust her, although she's never babysat a single time. And guess what? Everyone, no, to probably not to your surprise, every single person in the survey 100% answer, I'd hire the 13-year-old girl next door.
Right, right.
So that is relationship.
Sure.
That is my simplest way to capture it is that even after you talk about competence and reliability, there's still something about, I know John, I've worked with John, I have a relationship with John, I know what makes him tick, and that's so important to me. It's intangible, but it's critical.
So competence, reliability, relationship, over.
So now we move to the denominator, which thankfully is just one word, mm-hmm. motivation. And sometimes, you know, people, if motivation doesn't make sense, sometimes I shorten that down to just motive, mm-hmm. meaning what is the self-interest of this person? So a story to help describe this better is I've worked with an employee who was one of my great colleagues, knew him, loved him, trusted him in every way. And I knew that at his core motive was what was good for the organization. He wanted what was best for the company. But that all changed in a heartbeat when he had a daughter who became critically ill, ill with potentially a life-threatening illness. And that changed through no fault of his own. That completely changed where his head was at. That changed his self-interest. That changed his motive. He could no longer be accounted on. And like I say, in this case, sadly, no fault of his own. But you can imagine all kinds of changes of agenda, changes of what's motivating someone and how that would have a potentially dramatic impact on whether you're able to trust them or not.
So let me attribute the research here. This is based on the book, The Trusted Advisor Field Book, A Comprehensive Toolkit for Leading with Trust by Green and Howe. But you've modified this trust equation a little bit from the research that they've done. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's okay. Right.
So as we talk about trust then, there's kind of this interesting dichotomy you like to talk about between leadership capability and trust. Kind of has something, you know, similar to the equation a little bit.
Absolutely. You know, and I do find that 360-degree feedback, in other words, feedback that you get, usually in online surveys, from people that work around you, 360 degrees around you, meaning your boss and other people sort of above you in the organization, and then your peers and people that work more alongside you, and then those people who report to you. That kind of feedback provides tremendous insights into trust. And one of the ones that has captured me more than any other is the equation, if you will, between leadership and being trusted, and how that impacts the way you're viewed as an outstanding leader or not.
Yeah.
For example, if all of the data in my 360-degree feedback says I've got great leadership skills, and I mean this in the most generic sense of the word when I talk about leadership, so ability to be decisive, ability to communicate, ability to think strategically, ability to innovate, etc. If I score high on those, but I score low or lower even on being trusted, mm-hmm. what would you guess my overall sort of level of outstanding leadership scores out on a 360?
So I would think it would probably average out to maybe be kind of an average leader. That would be my suspicion.
Yeah, you're right, and you may even be generous. In a quantitative answer, mm-hmm. 3% of people with that profile turn out to be outstanding leaders.
Wow.
On a 360 score basis. Now, if you flip it and say, okay, so-and-so, Brad, doesn't have great leadership skills on these generic areas like decisiveness and communication, but he is highly trusted, then what would you expect that my sort of outstanding leader level of feedback to rate out?
Outstanding? It might increase a little, but I'd still think most people, you'd still kind of be in that average pile.
Right. And you're still maybe a little bit generous that, you know, you measure hundreds of 360 feedbacks, only 11% of those people turn out to be outstanding leaders.
Huh.
But now the punchline, when you put them together, so you've got outstanding raw leadership capabilities in these key leader areas and highly trusted. Would it be the 3% from the first scenario plus the 11% in the second scenario?
No, I don't think so. So there I would think that's the definition of an outstanding leader.
That is it. You know, and 88, 90% of the people who put those two components together grade out as truly outstanding leaders. So it's just another more quantitative way to bear out the fact, the importance of being trusted as a leader.
So let's talk about a few case studies. You've got some great ones over your years of experience, and there was one between the initial merger between General Mills and Pillsbury years ago.
Yeah, this was maybe one of my biggest personal aha moments in the importance of trust. This was in 2001 when General Mills was acquiring Pillsbury. Mm-hmm. A very significant moment in General Mills history because Pillsbury was just about the exact same size as General Mills. I mean, in fact, you could argue that the acquisition could have gone either way. Maybe Pillsbury could have tried to acquire us, except that they were already owned by another holding company. So We, General Mills, were acquiring them. And these are, historically speaking, longtime bitter competitive rivals in the packaged food industry, both headquartered in Minneapolis.
Right across the river from each
right
other.
Right across the river from each other, maybe even even in more modern times, 8 to 10 miles apart from each other. Competitive in every way. So really quite a surreal moment when all of a sudden it was announced that General Mills is acquiring Pillsbury. It's just kind of like, how could that possibly be? It would be like the San Francisco Giants acquiring the Los Angeles Dodgers. You know, bitter rivals. They could never come together.
Yeah.
So in that kind of context, I was assigned with being an integration leader to bring two of the largest divisions, the technology division for each company, together into one organization. And the minute that I was announced as a leader for that effort, the challenges, the questions, the paranoia just instantly surfaced. What people are you choosing? What policies are you choosing? What practices are you choosing? What benefits, policies, et cetera, anything you can imagine. And it was all asked in a spirit of tension, nervousness, paranoia. And so the insights I gained, to make a long story short, are I decided to that transparency was going to be key, that anything that was done in the proverbial dark smoke-filled room was going to exacerbate an already horrible trust situation.
Yeah.
So one thing was just creating a template that said, this is how we're going to look at every issue. This is how we're going to look at every organization. This is how we're going to look at every system, et cetera, for making a decision. We're going to bring all the stakeholders together. Anyone who has good knowledge from either side, the General Mills or the Pillsbury side, we'll bring them together. We'll have as long of a conversation as it takes to clearly understand it, and then we will make the decision based not on what organization the idea or the policy or the practice is coming on, but purely which is best. Mm-hmm. And if we decide that neither one is best, we'll create something different altogether. We will not just settle for one or the other.
Sure.
And so lesson number one was that transparency was key. That took a huge amount of the tension in this overpumped balloon out in a really good way. The second insight was that listening is almost more important than anything else. And it was the same process I described where we sit in a room and really hear out and make sure that everyone felt that they had been clearly understood. You know, we practiced all of that good active listening stuff where you play back what you think you've heard to make sure that the other person understands that you understand. And as we did that, we found out that 99% of the time, when a person felt that A, the process was transparent, and B, that they had really been heard, they were okay with the decision, and we could it had been such an exhaustive discussion that they could understand how we got to the decision we got to. And so it was less about winning and losing and much more about being heard and understood. So that was a huge lesson.
So the next experience I know you like to share is about the Vienna Boys Choir, and I'm curious to understand how this kind of applies to business.
Yeah, this would not have even been a part of this podcast, except that I just attended a Vienna Boys Choir presentation, and it was amazing. The level of talent and the caliber performance absolutely blew me away. But what really caught my eye is I went into that performance with an old picture in my mind of boys from Vienna performing in a huge cathedral in Austria, you know, in the 1960s. I'd seen something like that on TV. And what appeared on stage at this university in the US that I attended the performance at was so different. Number one, there were boys from, obviously, from every culture and every country around the world. And then the one that really caught my eye is the director was not the traditional Austrian male director that I had seen on TV years ago. It was a woman, a Korean woman.
Huh.
And she's the first Korean woman to ever direct the Vienna Boys Choir. And I spent a couple of years in Korea, and I actually speak some Korean. So I took the opportunity to chat with her after the performance. And I learned a lot of interesting things, but, you know, a couple of them were, one, the boys singing in the choir come from 17 different countries. They speak 14 different languages, and they've got this Korean, and you could tell by talking to her that the Korean director pretty much only speaks Korean. She can speak a little bit of broken English,
wow,
but she's not the master of 17 languages.
Yeah.
And they're performing songs in over 20 different languages. So how in the world do they do this? Oh, and to cap all of that off, she doesn't stand and direct them as a traditional choir director would. She's accompanying at the piano. Huh. So half the time she can't see them and they can't see her. So how in the world is this happening? And she talked all about trust. And she, what was fascinating to me is she said, and I've heard this before, that choirs like that used to traditionally be managed through fear.
Mm-hmm.
Fear of making a mistake and through fear of stepping in any way out of line. And she said, you know, the way we're doing things today and the kind of music we're trying to do with the kind of choir that we're trying to develop, we could never operate off of fear. We have to work off of an interdependency where we trust each other, where we each take turns leading and we each take turns following. And she said the entire model of fear is a losing model anyway. And that when I empower different boys who are the language experts for a particular song to take the lead, and they trust each other, that great things, they can soar to higher heights than they ever used to. And wow. I think that's really true. And I think that is a great metaphor for any kind of a workplace setting, is that when you create a mutual trust, interdependence culture, you can raise your game to a higher height than you ever did before. Certainly than you ever would by operating through fear.
Right, right. So another topic is about using innovation to build trust. And you've got some good examples from your dad's days at HP back
yes.
in the day.
My dad was a brilliant man because he chose to go work at Hewlett-Packard back in 1954 when it was basically a startup company or
yeah.
something just on the cusp. They were out of the garage. Hewlett and Packard were out of their garage in Palo Alto, but they were in one small building in Palo Alto. So they're a small company. And my dad ended up having a 44-year career there and had such an amazingly great experience. And he used to come home and talk to us as kids and share some of the stories. And we even got to interact as kids with Hewlett and Packard because they would host these, you know, close-knit little company picnics, and they would barbecue for everybody. So mm-hmm. I have a huge amount of respect for the original Bill Hewlett and Dave Packard. But I'll share two or three really short stories that I thought captured the way they fostered trust in the organization and the huge impact it had on the massive success that HP had in their first 10 to 15 years of history. So one is simply about speed bumps. And this one is near and dear to my heart because I used to build little, you know, 8-year-old built go-karts and roll them down the hills of the HP parking lot. And one day went in there and the there was a speed bump at the bottom of the hill.
Oh, no.
So it rendered my go-kart helpless to yeah. this huge speed bump. And the rest of the story comes from my dad, that Dave Packard came back from an international business trip and he saw the speed bumps in the parking lot. And he was significantly upset and started asking questions. How did these get here? Why are they here, et cetera? And people didn't really understand why he was asking all these questions or why he cared.
Sure.
And there maybe it's important, maybe it's not. There'd never been any accidents in the parking lot or anything like that. And he insisted that they be torn out that same week. And when people who couldn't understand asked why, he explained that to me is a symbol, Dave Packard speaking, that to me is a symbol of not trusting employees.
Huh. They've
never given us cause to not trust them.
Yeah.
And to me, Dave Packard says, symbolism is one of the most important things we can convey.
Huh.
And trust is one of the most important things we can convey. So you earn such great equity with your people when you find ways to convey that. And he found a really unique way in that.
Well,
moment.
I'm sure when they saw it got, when they heard it got torn out and why, that yeah. instilled even more trust in the employees.
Yeah, huge impact. The second story is almost the same, but it's a Bill Hewlett story that I completely was told to me by my dad. But HP in this one small building had a parts closet or a parts room. It's probably a better description. And they put anything in there that was old prototypes or old experimental projects or just extra parts and whatever. But it had always been a place, kind of a source of creativity for HP engineers to go in and look at these things or learn from old experiments and so forth.
Kind of a tinker room.
Tinker room, exactly. And one day Bill Hewlett came walking around. He was kind of famous for walking around and being in touch with everyone on the floor. And he saw a padlock on the parts room. And that had never been there before. Why on earth is there a padlock on that door? And somebody finally got to someone who had an answer and explained that, well, you know, once upon a time, that was a parts room with just a few old pieces of scraps and odds and ends in it. But now it's a parts room with, you know, a significant dollar value worth of stuff in it. And we felt like we should get it a little bit more secure. And he walked away, didn't say anything, and came back 5 minutes later with a massive bolt cutter. And he cut the lock off the door. And he put a piece of paper with scotch tape taped to the door that said HP trusts its employees. And again, you know, just like the speed bumps, powerful symbolism that these guys found incredible ways just on the spot spontaneously to convey how much they trusted employees. And that was returned. My dad, as just one of the rank and file employees of the company, would tell you that it was returned a hundredfold from employees that would give so much more and have so much more emotional capacity to give to the company because they weren't worried about covering their own rear ends.
So you talk about this dichotomy between, you know, sacrifice. So, you know, if you're sacrificing, are you gaining or are others gaining? How does that, you know, how does that dichotomy work?
Right. You know, I think when you think about when the average person thinks about corporate America today, they think about a world in which the CEO will cause others in the organization, lower down in the organization, to sacrifice in order that he or she may win.
Yeah.
And HP, the last point thing I'll share about them is they had the exact opposite model in their head, that we at the top will sacrifice so that others can win, or we will all find ways to sacrifice equally together so that the entire organization can win. And one real simple example of that, they were one of the first, if not the first, to come up with the idea. The first time HP hit a performance speed bump and they were having a not stellar year, their board of directors started to put pressure on them that, hey, maybe you've grown too fat. Maybe it's time to have some kind of a, and HP had never had a layoff. You know, maybe it's time to think about a layoff or a cutback or something like that. And they, you know, using both their innovation skills and this value of we're all in it together, they came up with the idea of a furlough or a concept where what if we all shorten our work week, both in hours and in pay, by about a half a day, and we weather the storm all together, and we all come out of it together, you know, having saved everybody's job.
Yeah.
And they did exactly that. It more than allowed them to meet their profit commitments because of this now new cost structure that they'd created. And again, imagine the goodwill. It was what that did for the culture of the organization is, you know, immeasurable.
Wow. Wow. So you have a couple examples of what happens when someone doesn't want to sacrifice, and then when someone does, of course. And so one was a fun story from the Chicago Bulls and Scottie Pippen years ago.
Yeah, you know, and I bet many people, if they're into basketball, all will remember this. But this is in one of those several eras where Michael Jordan was not on the team. He's off playing baseball or doing something else, one of his retirements. And Scottie Pippen, therefore, was the man on the team. And this is in the playoffs, and this is the Chicago Bulls and Scottie Pippen against the New York Knicks. And it's a critical game, and it's a game that has come down to the last second. The Bulls are down by a point, but the Bulls have the ball, and the Bulls have like 2, 3, 4 seconds. They have just enough time to get the ball in and get one shot off and hope that they can make it. If they make it, they win the game. If they miss it, they lose the game. Mm-hmm. So they're in a timeout, of course, and the coach, now I'm forgetting his name, pulls the team together, and Phil Jackson.
Phil Jackson, yeah.
Pulls the team together, and he draws up a play. This is what we're going to do. And the play was not drawn up to go to Scottie Pippen, who viewed himself as the man. And Scottie Pippen, in a poor leadership moment, had a bit of a hissy fit and elected to not go back out on the court.
So he sat on the bench.
Sat on the bench, and the media people thought he must be injured. Why on earth would the best player on the team not be going back out on the court? And he was sitting there because he didn't like the idea that the play was not drawn to him. I at least give him credit for being completely, wouldn't it be great if all of our corporate leaders would be that honest about how they felt?
Right, huh?
But so it's less important to the story, but it's interesting to note that they ran the play without Scottie Pippen. They ran it to Tony Kukoc, uh-huh. who made the shot, and the Bulls won the game.
Luckily, yeah.
But the idea is, I sometimes ask people if I'm in more of a workshop setting, what is the opposite of Scottie Pippen leadership, at least in that case?
Sure.
And it's, to me, the answer is it's servant leadership. In other words, it's not about me. It's not about my self-importance. It's not about, as Hewlett-Packard so beautifully demonstrated, it's not about what builds me up. It's about how can I serve the people that I am tasked with leading, and how can I make their world better? How can I build up their success? And that, in my own words, is servant leadership. And I think that is one of the key components of building a trusting environment, is where we have that. Back to 360 degree feedback, there's a great Harvard Business Review study that points out that humble leaders are the best leaders. And you could fill in that blank with servant leaders are the best leaders. And all they did was correlate leaders' trust scores to their overall caliber of leadership scores. And they found that there was a direct correlation between leaders who humbly scored themselves a little lower on their own 360 input.
Self-evaluation.
And those who did that, for whatever reason, their overall scores from all the people around them were the highest scores. So, you know, it's a logical conclusion in my mind to say that, okay, leaders who lead with a little bit more humility and a little bit more of a service orientation are highly respected, trusted, valued by their people.
So what happens, what's the impact then for people that have to work in an untrusting environment?
You know, this kind of goes back to what I was saying with the Vienna Boys Choir. And so I won't repeat myself too much, simply to say that when a leader can find a way to create that trusting environment for the people under him or her, the people that report to him or her, they have then created an environment where people no longer have to burn all of this energy on covering their own rear ends.
Yeah.
And I think that is one of the biggest dilemmas in most organizations, is that when I don't feel trusted by my boss, I've got to all the time worry about who I'm copying and who I'm covering and covering my own rear end. And I'm operating in fear. It's back to that Vienna Boy, the old Vienna Boy Choir model of I'm operating in fear. And when I operate in fear, I've got no time or energy left to fight the fight that actually needs to be fought, which is competing against the real competitors in the outside world, because I'm too busy spinning all my energy on the inside. And so, you know, that's the point. And it's like I say, I think it's one of the real dilemmas that we face with leaders who don't get this idea of servant leadership.
So you have a great story with a friend of yours that was in the military and his leadership example.
Yeah, and I'll wrap with this. This is a young man that the way I know him is I was kind of an adult leader advisor with a church youth group. And this was one of the young men. I knew him first when he was 16, 17, 18 years old as just a youth at church. But he was a good young man, nothing particularly remarkable. But he went on to be one of these ordinary people who ends up doing absolutely extraordinary things. And the short version of the story is Mark is his name. Came from humble circumstances, no money to go to college. And so he decided to sign up for the ROTC, I believe it's called, as a way to finance his college education. He never once thought that he would actually get drafted into any kind of an actual military experience. He just thought, I need to serve. I need to be in the ROTC. That'll fund my, and I can get a college education. But he made a commitment to do that. And as such, he was a young man of integrity. So when he did get called up and drafted into combat in Afghanistan, he, you know, was more than ready to meet his end of the obligation. And he went to Afghanistan. The area that he got assigned and trained in was, diffusing of IEDs, improvised explosive devices.
Yeah.
You know, a scary line of work to be assigned into, but he became quite expert at it. And he went from being a member of a team to being the leader of a team. And it was a highly successful team. Mark was expert. He trained his people to be expert. And he talked, this is servant leadership. He talked about how some platoons would run this in more of a dictator fashion, you know, where I've earned my way to being the leader, and so I'm going to have all of you guys do this now. I don't have to.
I'm not going to go near the bomb anymore.
I don't have to be the guy actually diffusing anymore.
Yeah.
Others would run it in more of a, he called it a roulette fashion, where we're all going to take turns,
yeah,
you know, and so that way I'm only doing it one out of every 10 times or something like that. He was the ultimate servant leader. He said, because I'm the expert and because I have confidence that I know all of the little tips and tricks and things that can make this the safest experience possible, I am going to be with you every time. And he made a commitment that he was shoulder to shoulder with whoever's quote unquote turn it was every time. And they had extraordinary success until a day when a bomb sniffing dog had made some kind of a mistake and set a bomb off that ended up
that they were near.
They were right near. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's a tragic story. Mark lost one of his arms and both of his legs.
Wow.
In this. And it was, you know, devastating beyond anything that I can even try to imagine. And he talked about how when he was shipped to a hospital in Germany and he was laying there, that he had these thoughts that he'd never had in his life about how he wished the bomb had just taken his life, because it was such a devastating and horrible and unimaginable circumstance. But typical to Mark, he very quickly, he talked about the shift came when he saw other people coming in that were just as bad off or worse than him. And once again, this servant leadership thing kicked in for him, and he became the rallying focal point for people at this hospital, this U.S. hospital in Germany. He became the one that took personal responsibility for cheering people up, for running games and little competitions, things that they could do to build their morale. And extraordinary. So once again, he put himself into this mode of, there's something I can do to serve the other people around me and build morale in this new version of a platoon that I live in. So, you know, some of the things that are just really cool to me in wrapping it up are that, one, Mark made a goal to be, when the rest of his platoon came home, that he would be able to walk out onto the tarmac, you know, in Washington, D.C.
Sure.
To greet and salute each of his platoon mates that had been serving with him in Afghanistan. And he did that. And I've watched video of him learning how to walk on prosthetic legs. And the courage was amazing. And his greeting and being greeted by the team that he'd worked shoulder to shoulder with was, you know, practically bring a tear to your eye because of the emotion and the love that team leader had for team and vice versa. And so, you know, I think about Mark and, you know, what are the attributes there? This is a guy who always acted out of true care for his team. This is a guy who never made anything about himself or his promotions or his advancement. It was always about what's good for the team. This is a guy who always said, you know, when people asked him the questions about why do you do this or why do you do that, he always said, that's the same thing that they would have done for me. He sort of lived with that attitude. He was honored in Washington, D.C. as one of the greatest platoon leaders that Afghanistan U.S. military had ever seen. And he worked to pick up people, even post-injury. He worked so hard to pick up people, even in their toughest times. And the cool, the cool ending to this story was when he came back to his home state of Minnesota, he found that a lot of these platoon mates, knowing that he was going to be in desperate financial situation, given his physical state, they had built kind of in Habitat for Humanity style. They'd built him and his wife a home to live in. And the little slogan, you know, on a plaque at the home was, he would have done it for us. So
that's cool.
Amazing story of a servant leader.
Wow. Well, Brad, thank you very much for the stories today, as well as the relevant points in building trust as a leader. We look forward to continuing this series on leadership intelligence and best practices, and we hope that all of you can join us on a future podcast. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.